The Pat Kenny Show on News Talk
with Matter Private Network. During current restrictions, don't ignore your health concerns. Our expert team is ready to help.
Born in Castlebar in County Mayo, Mark Mellett joined the Irish Naval Service in 1976. He rose through the ranks to attain the position of Chief of Staff of the Defence Forces, spanning 44 years. Well, it's our pleasure to be joined this morning by the aforementioned Vice Admiral Mark Mellett ahead of his retirement. Mark, good morning and welcome.
Good morning, Pat. It's great to be here.
Now, it's very interesting about you because you actually left the Defence Forces before you were old enough to join, originally.
Yeah,
the FCA.
That's right. I joined the FCA when I was 18, and four and a half or nearly 4 years later I left and I was still 18. I actually was 14 when I joined the FCA in Castlebar. I had been involved in a club, the Castlebar Ramblers Club, and as a youngster there at 13, I was chairman, and that club had adults and teenagers, and I just enjoyed the responsibility. We used to go climbing mountains, hiking, and do a lot of stuff in the town, picking up litter on the mall, involved in the Christmas lights for the community every year. And it just seemed a natural progression to go into the FCA then for a number of years. And there was a great leader there, a Congo vet, Commandant Mick Considine. And Mick mentored me over the years with Captain Billy Moran, also an FCA member, a neighbour of mine in Rathbone and Castlebar. And they encouraged me to join the Permanent Defence Forces, which I did in 1976.
Yeah. But was it usual at the time that a blind eye would be turned to your real age?
Well, I didn't know, but it seemed natural. Most of my schoolmates were joining, and I just went along with the flow, and I didn't see anything irregular in it. But in hindsight, it was, I suppose, unusual. It certainly is not tolerated today, unfortunately. And I know we'd probably have plenty of youngsters who would make the cut, but the recruitment age today is 18.
Yeah, perhaps there is a need for a junior FCA or something that would get kids involved. It might keep a lot of fellas out of trouble as well. Anyway, your decision to join the naval service, why the Navy rather than the Army?
Well, the strange thing is the FCA, or the reserve unit I joined, was the 5th Motor Squadron in Castlebar, which is an armoured car squadron. But Commandant Considine was an innovator even at that time, and he taught us all the sail, and we went to Rosmina in Westport and learned to sail, which was strange for cavalry people. But I loved to sea, and my dad had a boat down in Killary Harbour, and we used to go down there in the summer operating the boat called the Sharon Oak after my sister Sharon. And so from that side, I really enjoyed seagoing, and it seemed to be the natural way forward. Now, I have to be honest and say I actually would have preferred to join the Army at that stage, but I didn't make the cut, and I went on and went to Hub Olin, joined the Navy, spent some time in the Curragh with the cadet school there. And before I knew it, I was in Dartmouth with the Royal Navy doing my cadet training. And within 6 months, I was on the Mediterranean on HMS Fearless, watching the Soviet fleet as the Cold War flourished. It was really a fantastic time.
Absolutely, because you were at the front line, although not of our Navy, but you were at the front line as part of your training to see exactly how the great powers were pushing up against each other with their naval fleets.
That's true. And I still remember operating out of Valletta with the Royal Navy HMS Fearless. It's an LPD, a landing platform dock ship that carried a Royal Marine battalion. And we used to do exercises in Sardinia. Operation to other interesting places. I remember going into Venice and meeting Princess Margaret, and she asked me to tell Jack Lynch, would Ireland join NATO? And as a youngster, I didn't know what to do. I got into a lot of trouble because I didn't tell anybody when I came home.
Whether Jack Lynch would have paid a blind bit of notice to you is another question, and whether she was just being mischief-making, I suspect she was, having a bit of crack at the expense of a young cadet. Now, you went on, obviously, to qualify as a naval diver. What was the role that the divers typically played?
Well, yeah, we obviously are part of the maritime defence element of the defence forces in the Navy, and we have a specialist naval diving unit that has got a great record over the decades delivering services, defence, security and government services. And I remember one of my first operations was actually working on the St. Beaton. The St. Beaton had been sunk by the IRA in Lough Foyle. And it was on the median line between UK and Irish waters, and it was blocking the port approaches to Derry. So we went and we were responsible for clearing the St. Beaton, which was a very challenging operation. I remember diving in very challenging conditions. The current was about 2 to 3 knots in the area. And I remember hailstones as we sat on the upturned hulk of the ship itself and then diving down and going in what effectively looked like going into an open tin of beans, except it was the size of a human being, where the explosion had blown out the side of the ship. And what we were searching for was remnants of explosion before we could bring the salvor in. That's just one example. Over the decades, the Naval Service has gone from the diving unit from strength to strength. And I was delighted to see recently that Talia Britton, one of our newest young divers, a female, is the first in the history of the service to qualify there.
Now, you are the recipient of the Distinguished Service Medal, the DSM. That was back in 1994 as captain of the L.E. Orla. What did you do? What was the operation?
Well, I suppose the operation was recognising that the southern approaches to Ireland and the western approaches to Ireland for long before that had been recognised as a potential transit point or a transshipment point for narcotics, but we'd never had quite caught anybody red-handed. And a very smart guard down in Tralee had picked up a phone from a criminal, and he kept that phone on charge for a number of weeks. And one day the phone rang, and it was actually a smuggler at sea wondering where he was. He's been out there waiting for days and they weren't there for the pickup. The guard passed the message on to the defence forces, and I was about 120 miles away on L.E. Orla. We had to get there before dawn because the big challenge is hiding a ship. And my interpretation of the operation requirements, if I just sailed over the horizon towards a vessel that was suspected of doing something wrong, he would get rid of evidence, he would dump his narcotics, and we'd have no case. So we managed to cover that 120 miles just before dawn. I remember to this day, dawn was at 10 minutes past five on the 13th of July, 1993. And we'd transited through the Blasket Sound, rock dodging. We had been working at a speed of nearly 25 knots, that's 50 kilometres an hour. We had to take responsibility for every other vessel operating in the area, fishing vessels, salmon vessels, coastal vessels, and still arrive on task with enough time to launch our boarding crew before dawn broke. And we were there at 20 to 5. And I remember sending the boarding team off. They had their instructions. They were ready for force protection. But one of the elements of force protection in this case was potentially the element of surprise, that if you got there to the actual smuggler before he knew you were on scene, you could overwhelm them. And I was very conscious of the intelligence that we might gather if we overwhelmed the boat before we were there. And they did just that. In the final moments before they boarded the Brime, the skipper saw them, a man called Van Onsen. He was Dutch. The crew was made up of Belgian, British and Irish. But our crew were up to it and they overwhelmed the vessel. Not before the engineer on board had gone down and opened the sea chest valve and the water was pouring into the hull. And there were over 2 tons of narcotics on it. And our engineer who was on the boarding team scrambled down and he closed the sea chest. They overwhelmed the crew. They got really valuable inference. Van Onsen had gone down at that stage to wipe evidence of a computer, which was subsequently very valuable in the context of other criminal prosecutions.
Brilliant operation, absolutely. And, you know, risky because you had to care for the other seafarers who might be in very small boats fishing for whatever. And you're grinding along at 25 knots. So well, fantastic achievement.
We had a great team, Pat, and that's really what the Defence Forces is. It's not about one individual. It's about the collective. And I always say, and I say to this day, that you're as strong as your weakest link. And the crew of the L.E. Orla, they were the recipients of the Distinguished Service Medal. They were a remarkable team who actually really mucked in, got on together, really was a big, big happy family.
Now, you served in Lebanon, you served in Afghanistan. I'm wondering what your reflections are now that Western troops are pulling out of Afghanistan. Was it all in vain?
Yeah, I have a sense of sadness in terms of what has happened over the decades. I mean, it's over 20 years or around 20 years, I think, since the intervention in Afghanistan. And I was there in 2004, and I remember at that time, you know, having a sense that this could work, that actually, you know, the institutions of democracy were beginning to work. I was there working with others in terms of the coalition forces, the International Stability Assistance Force, the UN institutions, NGOs, and the interim government that was there in terms of Afghanistan. And there was a sense of optimism that we could bring, or they could bring this to a point of truth. But the real challenge at the time is Afghanistan in many ways is a pawn in terms of proxy activities from other states that are outside Afghanistan's border. And it's that interference that has been really, really difficult. And you often see that in other areas. And you see it in Syria today in the context of external influencing, which actually, to some degree, sustains conflict. And as I look back on Afghanistan, I have a sense of sadness now. I have a sense in terms of looking at the attempts at the time to try and address the issue of gender gap in Afghanistan. And one thing I've learned over the decades is that wherever you see gender gap, that's where women are not educated, or they're not employed, or they're oppressed, or not part of the political system, you have interstate or intrastate conflict. And there's an inextricable link between gender gap and interstate and intrastate violence. And I think of the progress that's been made over the last decade or so in Afghanistan in terms of trying to close the gender gap. And I have a sense of foreboding now in terms of what may happen into the future.
Yeah, the Taliban flexing their muscles and people fleeing from them. Who knows what lies there? But a country that has proved very difficult in terms of, you know, in the 19th century, Britain had its difficulties there. In the 20th century, obviously, the Russians. In the 21st century, the Americans and other forces. Looking towards the end of your tenure as Chief of Staff, it looks like you saved the biggest challenge of your career for the last couple of years. In other words, the pandemic and the role of the Defence Forces. You know, we don't hear or see much of it, but it could have been, if things had gone badly wrong in terms of the pandemic, it could have been a very major role, and you were preparing for that.
Yeah, well, I suppose that's the reason you invest in your defence forces. In many ways, we're like an insurance premium that's there to help the state to absorb shocks. And this last, and today's day 496 of Operation Fortitude, our joint task force, which we stood up to address the challenges and to support Paul Reid and the HSE, we're on priority call to the Department of Health and the HSE and other institutions in terms of dealing with the COVID pandemic. And I'm really, really proud of the loyalty and that dedication and that commitment of the women and men of the Defence Forces. Come at the hour, come at the organisation, in every front they have actually turned to, whether it's in the vaccination centres, whether it's in the transport, bringing in nearly 5,000 tonnes of PPE, which was brought in 259 flights by Aer Lingus, and then the distribution of that outside. The tracing at a very early stage, I remember Minister Coveney rang me and he said, we need an army of tracers. And I didn't even know what a tracer was. But very quickly, we turned to our cadet school, and our young trainee officers at that stage were to the forefront. And subsequently, over the year, they've been very much in terms of the trainer in the context of the whole tracing element. One of the first decisions we made at the time after standing up the Joint Task Force was to actually stand up pop-up test centres in both Dublin and Galway. And what we used in that occasion were our naval vessels. Our naval vessels in many ways. And I remember, you know, people talking about PPE. We didn't know in general what PPE is. Everybody knows what personal protective equipment is now. But back then, the real experts in the Defence Forces were the Ordnance Corps and the Naval Service, because they had to learn that in the Mediterranean, where in the previous few years, they'd been part of an operation in terms of Pontus and Sofia working with EU colleagues, and part of a rescue operation that saw them rescue 18,000 people directly and an additional 5,000 that they transferred to other vessels, women, men and children that would have died otherwise. But the critical point I'm getting to is that during those operations, they had to ensure that they protected themselves as a crew on the ship, because many of those who were rescued were potentially infected with, in the worst case, potentially Ebola, but other conditions and viruses that we couldn't afford for the ship to be infected with or it would go down. So rolling back to where we are with COVID, there has been a remarkable turning to by the defence forces. And in parallel to that, we've still continued our meat and two veg, if you like, the actual 13 missions in 12 countries, nearly 600 personnel throughout, huge sacrifices from the men and women, but also from their families. Because of the penalty of quarantine beforehand and afterwards, there has been no leave for these missions. So our personnel have been effectively separated from their families, from their children, for up to 7 months at a time. Our Air Corps has been involved in transportation over to Germany, and as well as the Emergency Aeromedical Service, and our Navy has maintained our patrols at sea.
Yeah. Now, Mark, one of the gruesome things you had to think about, building perhaps temporary morgues, field hospitals. Happily, that never materialised, but you had to prepare.
Well, we had to prepare. And in fact, I steal Paul Reid's line on this, one of the best waste of time was actually dismantling large pop-up, if you like, mortuaries that we had to put into our facilities in Collins Barracks and in Stephens Barracks in Limerick. And we had to be prepared for the situation. The choice in the early days was going to be coffins with dignity or body bags in a hole. And it really was worrying when we looked at the actual initial statistics. But I think this is a remarkable story in terms of public service collaboration across the state. I think the leadership from government, the leadership in terms of the officials in the Department of Health and through all organisations, and I include my own in that, has been second to none. And we've got a good story to tell. In fact, in many ways, I'm an optimist, and I like to look to the future. And people talk about a new normal. I want to look towards a better normal, whereby we have learning from what we've seen through this pandemic, and that we can apply that learning to give us a better normal, so that perhaps we have blended learning, we have more remote working into the future, and that the dividend from this is not wasted on us.
All right. Well, some of the texts coming in. Vice Admiral Mark Mellett was excellent Chief of Staff and served with distinction. Best of luck to him in the future. From another one, Joe in Mayo. Please pass on my best wishes to Mark Mellett on his magnificent role he played as Vice Admiral of the Defence Forces. Best of luck in the future. It's signed Joe Mellett. Would that be one of your biggest fans and a relation?
He's my cousin, I hope, Joe. Oh, sorry, maybe it's Joe in West Wentford, who's not related, and he owns a very good pub there. I think Mellett's Emporium, so I might get over there during the summer.
Another one from Gráinne. By golly, I could listen to the former Chief of Staff, not quite gone yet, but retiring. Is there a book in the offing? And it prompts my final question, Mark. What next for you? Is it a graceful retirement? Is there a book in you, or is there another project?
Yeah, I think there's another project, and I'm working on that at the moment. I may take some time to reflect. I mean, I've had a few people asking me, what's the future? I have a few letters in already. And I suppose my point is I want to get home to my wife, Liz. I'm on the road for 8 years. Our first grandchild is just 4 weeks old tomorrow. And we're going to take a few weeks off. But no, I'm not hanging up or not swinging my hook yet. I have a little bit more gas in the tank. I train every day, and I think that's an important part of actually staying well. And also in terms of keeping yourself mentally fit requires that you keep your brain engaged.
All right. Well, we wish you the very best for whatever the future holds. And Vice Admiral Mark Mellett, who is the retiring Chief of Staff of the Defence Forces, thank you very much for joining us on the programme.